There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello? Okay, it's working. I'd just like to make it clear to our listeners that I am fully responsible for this edit, and the production values are going to be lower to what you've become recently accustomed to. Anyway, Ned and I still had a good chat, so there's no music. Bye.
Hello, David.
Hi, Ned.
How's it going?
Yeah, good, good. We're just trying to get our head around what happened the last few days.
Well, it's been, what is it now, Wednesday? It's been 10 days since I said goodbye to you in Maidstone, in Kent, I think.
Yeah.
And
quite a lot's happened since.
Yeah, probably more for you than me. But a lot's happened in the cycling world. We could start with, I don't know, it's up to you. We could start with cycling, or we could
I think we start with bike racing. Let's properly not stray far immediately.
All right. In the spirit of that, I have the revelation that I have kind of made over the last 10 days. Actually, no, probably the last 10 days plus a week. What's that? Seven, 17 days. Let's call it that.
That's how desperate we've got. Filling space in trying to add a week to 10 days.
In the last roughly 17 days, David, I wonder whether you've kind of been on this similar journey, but I have to confess, I didn't know 17 days ago that Richard Carapaz, before the Pyrenees, that Richard Carapaz was the bike racer that he is. I didn't know that. And Rendalero, to his great credit, kind of did. And and I stand corrected. I don't think I ever said he wasn't the bike racer, but I just internally had my doubts.
Well, we caught glimpses of the Tour de France when he did his proper bike racer move, where he turned a mountain stage into a classic and was bluffing and doing his different games, which I've never seen before.
Yeah.
And he got a little bit, and even I was like, you don't do that, you don't do that. Or people, but actually he's a bike racer.
Yeah. That was the Col du Portet stage, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then when I turned on, because I was running out and got to different places and saw that he'd won, you were like, wow, you're a bike racer. Because afterwards, even in the post-race interviews, I saw Pogacar was saying he didn't know why he attacked where he did.
Yeah.
Because he's still a kid. He's emotional. He's excited. He's in the place. And he looks really happy with his bronze medal. But Carapaz doesn't race like that. He races to win. And yeah, I think it's a really good indication for where Ineos Grenadiers can go, because they've got a proper one-day star racer who can do Grand Tour races. And I think what he did at the Olympics was very redemptive for their whole team.
Because he was away, wasn't he, with Brandon McNulty? That was the move, wasn't it, in the Olympic road race?
Yeah, Pogacar's teammate is UAE teammate.
His teammate, which is one of the weirdnesses of the Olympics.
The dude who crashed off the hillside.
And he just rode McNulty into a standstill, didn't he? He just rode him into
oblivion. Yeah, he did, and Wout van Aert was there, and he had his whole team doing everything, and Remco Evenepoel, my darling boy, was there, but he was on sacrificial lamb duty early on.
Yeah.
And then, but Wout van Aert kept bringing back on, and Pogacar lit things up on the penultimate climb, and there were super big climbs.
It was
like the kind of Tour de France.
Meters or something,
yeah, it was nuts. The fact Wout van Aert was even there is insane.
Yeah.
And then, but it was, and what I kind of loved about it was all these riders that pull out of the Tour de France to not to save themselves the Olympics.
Craziness. Yeah.
No, they don't. It's like, I think 8 of the riders in the top 10 finished the Tour de France.
Yeah.
because it's this weird thing. You finish it and you feel exhausted, you feel terrible, but you're stronger than you've ever been.
Yeah.
And the sensible and all the physiology and all the data will tell you to stop doing the Tour de France if you want to get the best out of yourself at the one day race a week later. And the black science, the black art says, finish the Tour de France, you'll feel terrible, but you'll be stronger than you've ever been in your life. You've just got to overcome 4.5 hours of wanting to stop the race. And that's what was amazing about watching the Tour de France. Even with all the data and science they have now, they still can't quantify or qualify why a 3-week grand tour turns you into this absolute weapon of a human being. And so that was what I found interesting with the road race.
Because all those riders, like, who was it at the Tour de France? It was the changing of the script, wasn't it? And the kind of destruction of the old wisdom. Because you're absolutely right. I think it was Jakob Fuglsang. Did he go? He went early from the Tour de France, didn't he? Having made no impact on the race. And likewise, Vincenzo Nibali, last chance saloon for him, and he went early. But they were kind of going through, you got the sense with the benefit of hindsight, that decision-making process is going through the kind of vapors left in the tank of kind of old thinking. Go back to the drawing board, because it turns out the more you race, the better you are.
I think we should go to talk about the Women's Road Race, because that's going on that same narrative, kind of rips the rule book up. And then after that, and I dare say it, we should talk about mountain biking after that.
The first ever mountain bike race I've ever watched.
The Women's Road Race did exactly what we've just been talking about in the opposite way.
Yeah, yeah. So the Women's Road Race. So Carapaz won the Men's Road Race. The next day, the Women's Road Race was equally fascinating in a completely different and bonkers way. This five-rider breakaway got away, I think I'm right in saying, and one by one they were kind of caught eventually. Two riders were caught, and then when I started watching the race, three riders, I think I'm right in saying, had still had something like a 9-minute lead with, I want to say, 45K to go or something, including some big climbs.
And I think they maxed out 11 minutes, didn't they?
I got a feeling they had 19 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, it was. I think it maxed out 11 minutes. I think that was, but none of the teams behind Chase, okay,
maybe,
because they
maybe
were,
you're right, yeah.
But, because they didn't consider them threats.
Well, so here's the thing with the women's peloton, which is tiny at the Olympics, isn't it? What was it, 70 riders strong or something? So really kind of like, In quite an uneven peloton anyway, which is, you know, I don't think I'm kind of saying anything controversial there, that the difference between those who are at the top of their game and world-class and those who perhaps aren't is greater than in the men's peloton. So it's, you know, shelves off quite quickly, and it's even more exaggerated in the Olympic road race, I suspect. But even within those teams who were strong, you know, there was a world of difference between the Netherlands and everybody else.
Yeah. We're British. We had two riders.
Yeah. And the Italians, I think they had Elisa Longo Borghini and one or two others, maybe three. The Dutch had, in that final peloton, they had four absolute hitters. They had Anna van der Breggen, they had Marianne Vos, Demi Vollering, and of course Annemiek van Vleuten. Between them all, you're thinking, well, it's almost a national disgrace if they can't engineer a victory here somehow. Yeah. I mean, they were that, you know, they were in that much of the box seat. By the time the peloton was whittled down to a fairly select group, almost every other one of the favourites, like Longo Borghini, like Cecilia Utrup-Ludwig, like Kasia Nevia-Doma, like Lizzie Deignan, were unsupported. And they still had four there. They had the four that I've just mentioned, you know. So they...
I'll just jump in, because although the win was amazing, it from all the women's bike racing we've seen, it was not a good advert for women's bike racing.
In what terms, David? Because I mean, I kind of know what you're getting
just
at.
The passiveness.
Stand that up a bit.
The passiveness, the fact that everyone called each other out, and it wasn't. It's just not. There was no aggression. There wasn't any. There was too much wanting to beat each other, even within your own team. It was, what's the common goal? The common cause. The goal. Why are we doing this? And it just, everyone just tripped each other up. And it was like, God, come on. You've got it. You can do this.
However, so the added complication was eventually that three rider group fell apart that I was talking about. The one with 9 minutes still, you know, of a lead. Maybe they still had 5 minutes or something like that. This is slightly floating here because I've kind of forgotten exactly what what the numbers were at this point. Yeah. But Anna Kiesenhofer decided from a long way out, this Austrian rider, unheralded rider, really, to go it alone. And off she went, a long way out. And you know, really late on, and this kind of you and Peter were very funny on our WhatsApp group, sort of like complaining about the fact that the race finished on a motor circuit being really lame. And I completely agree with you. You know, both in the men's and the women's road race, it looked dreadful. But then, you know, when they got onto the motor racing circuit, then the Dutch started eventually to work as a kind of homogenous unit and actually to do what you see in the men's road race, in men's road racing, put the team on the front because they did have the team and work for one end. But it was only when you realised that Anna Kiesenhofer was going to win, and still they were riding hard, and they swept up with a couple of kilometres to go. They swept up the other two riders and still left Kiesenhofer with a couple of minutes advantage to take the win solo. Then you realise that, okay, so this is Annemiek van Vleuten who'd attacked off the group, caught the others, passed them, and was now second on the road. She crosses the line, a minute and a half after the winner, and celebrates.
Yeah,
and I remember watching that live, thinking that's odd because that's Annemiek van Vleuten.
Yeah,
why is she? Why is she celebrating a silver medal to Anna Kiesenhofer, who she probably hasn't even heard of?
And I saw the polemics that they haven't seen the boards. There were no time gaps. They were getting the time checks. It's you see it, and it's the race does that because it would have been a much bigger controversy if the race hadn't been supporting with regular time checks on boards from motorbikes.
So that's they didn't
up to
have
you. That's up to you to see if you notice them or not.
They didn't have the radios though, did they?
No, right? No radios.
And so most of these riders are only used to riding with radios.
But that's my point. It's the Olympics, the biggest bike race in the world. You know, there's no radios. So you have to understand there's going to be motorbikes that come by with boards that show you the time. That's your only data check.
Okay, but I don't understand quite what the point is you're making. Are you saying you can either be one or two things? One is they knew that they were riding for second place because they had all this information. Or they had all this information but misread it and they didn't know they were riding for second place. Which of those two do you think it is?
I think the second one. And I think because they haven't had enough experience of racing with relying solely on blackboards.
Yep.
And the briefing wasn't sufficient to tell them this is what you're going to rely upon. That's it. Once you cross that start line until the finish line, we have no information for you.
Amazing.
You have to adhere to those motorbikes and those blackboards.
Yeah.
That's all you've got. And you relay that to each other.
Yeah.
And that's what this bike race is going to be.
Yeah.
And you prepare for that and that's what you do. And there's simply no excuses, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And that's just bad preparation. But what I love about it and what I love about the race is the fact, and this is what I love about women's racing, is an amateur can win.
And she is an amateur in the greatest sense of the word. But she was phenomenally strong on the day. You know, she'd been off the front from the beginning of the race.
Yeah.
And as you say, it wasn't as long as the men's race, but it was an extremely hard course.
It's, what she's done and what she's done and who she is just insanely magical.
Yeah.
We could do 10 podcasts with her and not even tap into what even who she does, who she is, what she does. Anna
Kiesenhofer is a mathematician par excellence, isn't she? She did a degree in Vienna, the University of Vienna, went on to do postgraduate studies at the University of Cambridge. And then David, just up the road from you, completed her PhD, I understand it, at the University of Catalonia.
Yeah.
Whatever that is. Is that in Barcelona? I don't know.
I imagine it's in Barcelona.
One of her most recently published works is entitled Non-Communicative Integrable Systems on B-Symplectic Manifolds.
Yeah. But why? And you know what? And this is, you know, in our commentary occasionally I say game theory.
Yeah.
She literally went into that race because she didn't have a teammate. And she knew her only chance, mathematically calculated, was to hit out long.
Yeah.
And did all these variables and played her only card.
Yeah.
She had one card and she played it.
And it was brilliant.
And it's you're right. Brilliant. How and she won that race with total legitimacy and is the worthiest Olympic champion.
Yeah, yeah.
Because how she won it, she literally raced it.
Yeah.
And decided the only way I can win this race is heading out early and taking it to the line.
And also and having the balls to leave the other two as early as she did. You know, go solo.
Yeah.
Because that's what created the confusion, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, and I think just to conclude that, she is a completely worthy Olympic champion.
Yeah.
She beat Lizzie Deignan. She beat the Dutch team.
Yeah.
And she did it because she planned it.
Yeah.
And she trained for it and she did it.
Yeah.
Textbook, and the stars aligned, but she, and I think every single woman in that race that race against her will say, yep, she beat us.
Yeah.
And that's racing.
And as far as I understand it, one of the first riders to congratulate her, because I think some of the riders were a little bit reluctant to congratulate her from what I understand early on.
Oh,
having
really?
Kind of absorbed the shock that they hadn't picked up the gold medal, they picked up the silver medal, you know, etc. Was Cecilia Utrup-Ludwig, which says a lot for Cecilia's nature, I think, that she recognised the achievement.
She also critiqued the racing style of the peloton.
Well, she's got, this is a big bugbear of hers.
Yeah.
And she's deeply frustrated by the way that the
negative racing peloton, style.
The negative, the lack of organisation and the lack of your communication actually on the road and kind of common understanding of what needs to be done in a certain situation. Hey, listen,
so
Anna Kiesenhofer's Non-Communicative Integrable Systems and B-Symplectic Manifolds, if you want to read it, is available online for a small fee in the International Scientific Journal named Regular and Chaotic Dynamics, David. Isn't that brilliant? Because
that's bike
pretty
racing.
Much, that's bike racing, isn't
regular
it?
And chaotic dynamics.
Perfect.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Perfect, perfect.
Yeah.
And the other thing, just to sort of wrap up what was, I think, clearly, because I enjoyed the men's road race. I enjoyed the women's one more because it was so mad. But the shot of the day was after she'd crossed the line, she collapsed on the ground. I don't know if you saw that, David, and she was expiring. I mean, I kind of stopped in my tracks and went, is she okay? I mean, like, actually, is she okay? Because she'd gone so deep. She was, you know, literally the kind of deep death rattle breaths and all this sort of thing. But, you know, after a split second of looking at her, you realize, she's okay. Because there was this light in her eyes, you know, because she had just done something off the scale, you know.
Yeah.
And much as you celebrate Richard Carabas's confirmation of his massive ability and talent, this was just one of those special Olympic moments, wasn't it? It was. Really,
it was. And I think just the Olympics, I have a complex relationship with. But when
go on then. Go on, tell us about that.
Doing probably later on because it gets a bit darker.
Okay.
but it's at the moment, just to segue across to mountain biking. And watching Pidcock, it was because I was gutted because I was in England and I was because of my little Olympic resentment. I don't buy into it. My wife does. My family do. But then I came down and I'd been out doing something and I learned Pidcock had won. And I was like, how did you, what? Pidcock won?
Did you not watch him win?
No, I didn't. And it's. I don't regret much of my life. I wish I'd watched it live. I then watched it that evening on Hit the Red Button, went back and rewinded it with Archibald, with my Archie, my oldest boy, sat and watched it.
Well, he's the mountain biker, right?
Archie? He's the mountain biker.
Yeah, yeah.
And watching Tom Pidcock do it, it was sublime.
Yeah. Just, what? That's the right word.
And it was sublime. And I saw, and the course was beautiful.
Wasn't it?
The Japanese organization, everything. It was the most perfect mountain bike cross country course I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And everything was just right. And he did it. And what was nuts was just like the Dutch women team had made mistakes in the road race. How did Matthew van der Poel not know? Or forget. And so I've thought about this since.
What, the ramp had been taken
ramp,
away?
The way he crashed out and where he crashed. Because, and he even said afterwards, and then you see all the confusing interviews afterwards, and his coach is saying, oh, no, I spoke to him about it in the morning. Let's not forget that Matthew van der Poel has just gone through one of the most emotional racing experiences of her life 3 weeks before, a month before. And even the greatest athlete in the world makes a mistake. And I genuinely think he'd forgotten and he'd been told over and over again that the ramp has been taken out.
That's quite a big deal because without that ramp, that's a 5 foot drop, isn't it?
And he literally, and this was so humanizing, and it was, you just thought, oh, Mathieu, you made a terrible mistake. And that's the Olympics. Everyone else knew, and you know, and you've prepped and you do this. This is why you are who you are. And he even left the Tour de France. He said, I spent 4 years working towards this and he forgot the ramp. Because then, and we can come on to that afterwards regards Simone, Biles, the gymnast, is sometimes it becomes, you're overwhelmed. And I think Mathieu van der Poel just became overwhelmed and still, to this day, will say no one told him.
Yeah.
Because he was just had so much pressure on his shoulders that he'd put upon himself. But then, contrary to that, Pidcock, 21 years old, and just a weapon. And I was like, whoa. He was gracious. He was wonderful and beautiful.
It's a slight bit of hyperbole, but I think it's the second mountain bike race I've ever watched. I remember vaguely tuning in London to the coverage of the London, and I can't remember where the London course was, but it didn't strike me as half the spectacle of this Japanese course, which, as you say, was absolutely beautiful.
And
it was like a film set, actually. It was incredible. It was it just looked great. And also, you know, it kind of married, self-evidently, it married the sporting challenge with the aesthetics kind of perfectly, didn't it? But the difference between Pidcock and the way he seemed to race and everybody else in the race was like they were in two different disciplines, wasn't it? I mean, he was running on rails, as calm as you like, faultless. And everyone else was on the limit, ragged, and occasionally, you know, things were happening to them. They were puncturing or they were slipping up. Or at one point, the Swiss chap who was chasing him had to get off, dismount, and go cyclocross and run. And Pidcock was just drifting along, wasn't he? It was absolute. I mean, regardless of what Pidcock goes on to do for that, he's only 21. It's ridiculous. But, you know, whatever he go on to achieve, David, I think he'll always look back at that race and go, might have peaked there, you know.
Yeah, it's really interesting you say that, Ned, because as a racer who's done those things, we've spoken about these magic days, and you don't know when they're going to happen. You can be 15, you can be 18, you can be 21, you can be 28, you can be 34.
Yeah.
They happen very rarely.
Yeah.
And watching Pidcock, you're like, whoa, you're in full flow. This is all the science, everything they're doing about neuroscience and plasticity and the abilities that humans have to do things. He was in full flow.
Yeah.
And even he'll finish that race at 21 and go, whoa, I don't know if I'll ever touch that again because it's out of your hands. But he's worked for it over many years and he's got this particular genetic makeup and he's worked so hard and gone through these different avenues and he almost won Amstel Gold Race this year, for God's sake, which is 260 kilometers and a road race and a very complicated road racing situation.
He's about to go and race the Vuelta, for God's sake.
Is he?
Yes.
Oh, brilliant.
With all the hitters there, the Vuelta's going to be amazing.
He's our very own Evenepoel. But Evenepoel... Because Evenepoel doesn't know how to mountain bike or cyclocross.
We know that now, don't we? After the gravel sector in the Giro.
Yeah. So with Pidcock, and I've kind of always been, and I'm just like, I'm so hesitant because I don't want to put that burden in my thinking. But I think we've got the greatest ever in the cup of our hand.
And
you're just like,
super exciting, isn't it?
Let's not.
You know, when I was actually Girona commentating, you know, we did Never Strays Girona or whatever the hell it was called back then. And I was going off, you remember every day I'd go off on my runs behind the cathedral and out. I think it was around about then, early on in that week, that he crashed. Or he had that accident, that training accident.
Yeah, where he shattered his pelvis in five places he broke it. Yeah. And
I know he lives in Andorra, but for whatever reason, he was actually recuperating. He'd had his operation in Girona and was in Girona then, which I hadn't realized. And I hadn't even realized he'd done it. But I was just hobbling back from one of my runs when I was kind of looking at my phone and I saw the news. So I sent him a message, just a little picture message of me with the very identifiable Cathedral of Girona in the background, saying, I'm really close by, Tom. Wish you all the best wherever you, you know, yeah. all that sort of thing. He got straight back to me saying, bored. You know, this is like 24 hours after his break. He was just, and what was it, six days later? He was back, you know, on the bike.
I think it's my friend, Marty Costella, who looks after all of us. Who's an amazing, he's my age, he's 44.
Okay.
And he was a brain surgeon.
So he's the surgeon who does your...
Well, he was a brain surgeon who owns two sports centres and does different things. And he's the most ethical human being in the world. He doesn't believe in... he wants homeopathic stuff, but he's a brain surgeon. Uh-huh. And he's mad as a box of frogs. I love him to death.
Yeah.
But I think he's the person that supported Tom through that.
Tom, yeah.
Matt, yeah. So Tom was
David,
a really nice.
What do you think? What do you want? I suppose they're two different questions. What do you think Pidcock's greatest achievement could be? And what do you want it to be? Because they're two different things. I mean, would it be the Tour of Flanders or would it be the Tour de France? Or could it be both? Where does it lie on the road?
That's a really good question, actually. I don't know if it's so binary for this new generation.
Yeah.
In the sense, I don't think I have to win the Tour de France, I have to get an Olympic gold medal. And which I think is great. For Tom Pidcock, I would love to watch him spend a decade winning whatever he enjoys and racing all the time. Because I think that's something we've lost. We've become quite binary. So if we could go, the next Olympics, you want to do the mountain bike, go and do it. If you want to go and try and win the Tour de France, go and do that. And just have him, it's like watching a movie, watching it unfold and watching him just enjoy it and love it.
But so we've had these great British riders come through in recent years who have been outside the system. And one thinks of Adam Yates. In particular. But Adam Yates is an incredibly specialised rider. You know, he's always known what he's about, nonetheless. Pidcock is, again, he's a slight outsider in the sense that he's not gone near, as far as, you know, he's not really been part of the track programme, has he ever? Yeah.
I don't know. This is a really kind of easy one, because I got three children, 9-year-old boy, 8-year-old boy, and a 5-year-old girl. They're not going to get inspired by the Yates brothers. They're not going to get inspired by Geraint Thomas or Bradley Wiggins. They're not going to get inspired by Chris Froome. They love Mathieu van der Poel. They love Wout van Aert. They love Tom Pidcock.
Yeah.
They love bikes. They love bike racing. They love bicycles. And they don't differentiate. Oh, it's a bicycle. Let's go and race it. And I think that's what I think is magic.
It's weird though, isn't it? It's still weird because... Here we are. We've been talking about this amazing kid winning this amazing race that was beautiful to watch for 10 minutes. And yet, I think you and I both, because our hearts both beat for the road, right? Mm. We're both kind of like thinking, actually, Pidcock and the road is kind of what we want, what we ultimately want to see, regardless of how attractive it is to a generation younger than us to be messing around, jumping over boulders and stuff and, you know, hauling yourself through the mud. There are still, to my mind, nuances within road racing and the dynamics, the fluid dynamics of a peloton and the tactical complexity of road racing that still is where I think everything resides for me still.
I'm with you 100%. And I think that's when you see Mathieu van der Poel, who's a mountain biker, cyclocross rider. I've shown the kids the Canyon video they did where they do all the hyper editing between all his different skill sets. And all the romantic of his father, his grandfather.
Here's the thing, David. So I just started over the last few days trying to pick up on all the work, as I'm so far behind with so much writing work and various different bits and pieces. I dared to open an email today that said, Ned, you were supposed to write the stage-by-stage reports for the Tour de France for the road book. I completely forgot. Now, obviously, when we were in Maidstone, I could have done that every morning.
I know.
You know, while it was still fresh in the mind, put out 300 words, you know, really good, really kind of like, but now I've got to recreate it all from scratch. So this morning
I thought
sat
you
down,
were doing that.
No, I wasn't like an idiot. I thought Rendell was doing it.
Oh,
anyway,
no.
I said I'd do it and I forgot. So now I'm having to do it. So today I spent the whole morning writing the first 8 stages up, right?
That's impressive.
And when I got to stage 2,
1800 words.
The Mur de Bretagne stage, where Vanderpool won and took yellow.
That reanimated you.
Ah, David, I was reliving it from scratch again, loving it all again,
yeah,
and appreciating it even more because you talk about Vanderpool. Remember, David, he was going into that stage with a double ascent of the Mur de Bretagne. He was precisely 18 seconds down on Julien Alaphilippe in the general classification. 18 seconds. He knew that there were 8 seconds of bonus sprints and 10 seconds at the finish line. So he went, I've got to win the bonus sprint on the first climb. I've got to win the stage and take the 10 seconds and make sure that Alaphilippe doesn't take any. And I've got to gap him by at least a second. That is an impossibility.
It's an impossibility.
Riders,
what he did is an impossibility.
Against normal riders, it's an impossibility. He did it against Julien Alaphilippe, who had destroyed the peloton of the Tour de France the day before the world champion. Mm. And Mathieu van der Poel did it somehow.
Yeah.
And do you remember commentating that first ascent of the And we went, what's he doing, the idiot? That's not how you win the stage.
You can't do what he did.
It was just
mind-blowing.
And I think
all of this kind of wraps back around to the mountain bike race. And this is sport. And I can't ever imagine what it's like when your father was a champion Dutch racer in the 1980s.
Adrie.
And the woman he married, her
Corinne.
Father,
yeah.
Corinne, was Poulidor. And Poulidor is the who I've met numerous times, and you have as well, the greatest ever non-winner of the Tour de France.
Yeah.
And then you got his grandson. So if we switch now to Raymond Poulidor's perspective, and there's that lovely video, you put it on your social media, and I've seen it before as well, that little highlight reel.
The Dutch TV documentary.
Dutch TV, where Mathieu, as an 18-year-old, turns up to the Tour de France for the first time and hangs out with his grandfather.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
And his grandfather is literally swanning his grandson around, saying, he's better than me. This is my boy. And it's like any grandfather would be, but the love radiates from that whole clip. And so then to put that in the perspective of where he was, where he didn't win the first day, which would have been his plan at this year's Tour de France.
100%.
And he didn't. And I've spoken about this and I did it briefly, I think in one of our previous podcasts from commentary. There is, and I would love to capture it, is Alaphilippe crossed the line and he's done what he did. And then Van der Poel literally pulls up next to him and collapses on his handlebars. And his body language is sadness. Absolute sadness. Because that was his one opportunity to do what his grandfather never did, which was wear the yellow jersey.
Yeah.
And then what I find remarkable is he then went to bed that night and then the next day said, as he said, 18 seconds to get. I'm going to have to get, the only way I can do this, get the points in the first line, then do this and win the sprint by a gap. And he started that next day and he did it. And when he crossed that line, he pointed his finger. It was like, holy shit, you're Mathieu van der Poel. You're not Raymond Poulidor. And only Mathieu van der Poel could pull that off.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in the post-race interview, when our friend Seb Piquet asked the questions and just asked, who are you thinking? And he said, my grandfather.
Yeah.
And he said it in the gentlest way.
Yeah.
But it's even, I kind of feel a bit emotional now.
No, goosebumps.
Goosebumps. My
grandfather. That was a really special day of racing, wasn't it?
I mean,
that's
going back. That's what road racing is.
Yeah.
There's so much history on every single one of those roads. Yeah. There's so many narratives. There's so many different finishes that we go back to. It's not just a course. Mountain biking is great for the kind of skills, but road racing is history.
Hmm.
It's stories, it's people, it's things that we forget and are forced to remember.
Mm.
And that's road racing. And so that's why you and I are big fans of road racing and yet appreciate greatly mountain biking and the other disciplines.
Yeah, it was pretty special. Didn't watch the time trials, did you?
No, I didn't either. No. And yeah, I was, because I kept watching it on Twitter, and I was like, oh, it's the greatest time trial ever.
Oh, really? Was it? Which one? The men's or the women's or what?
The men's, because it was all so close for so long.
Why was it so good? I don't know anything about it. Dumoulin finished second, which was pretty special.
But then I saw the finish, and Roglic won by a minute. And I was like, guys, really? It's like, so the first lap was close.
Doesn't sound too close to me, yeah.
And then Roglic just destroyed everybody. But then there's a lovely, and again, road racing. The only reason that I've got a little bit of affection to it is because I was a time trialist, but also Roglic has got his redemption.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I always hesitate with the word redemption. I think it's a bit of a lazy sports journalism word. Like, yeah. There's nothing. He didn't have to redeem anything.
No,
he just had to give himself the reward for some sort of reward for a season's preparation.
And
a confirmation of the talent that he is. You know, and maybe he will win the Tour de France one day.
Can we do a paradigm shift here quickly?
Yeah, go.
This is AOB kind of dropping in. Simone. Biles,
I think, yeah.
The gymnast. Yeah. And I was just speaking to my friend, because I have some Asian friends, and we have a...
David, just tell me, so was she the greatest gymnast of her generation?
Yes.
With a huge amount of pressure. She's voluntarily withdrawn midstream from the Olympics, or I literally don't know what the story is.
One of the only times, because my wife's super into the Olympics, that I was watching something live, and it was a team event, and she did one of the vaults and then came off and then just walked off.
And she was done. That's it.
She was done. And then the post-race things is all, then everyone's, it's all gone mass on media. But then I was reading now today, because I'm quite into this sort of thing. She had what's called in gymnastic terms, the twists in the morning, which is like in baseball or cricket or any technique sport where you have
the yips.
She had in gymnastic terms, it's called the twists.
Okay.
She couldn't connect herself. Okay. And it's the first time they'd never seen it, and she was doing it in training. So when it happened on the vault, she realized she was deep in a twist. In gymnastic terms, that means you've either got a few hours or days or sometimes years to get over the twists.
Yeah.
And she realized it happened in this morning. So she just walked out. She was like, I can't connect my mind to my body now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we all took at this one thing. Then there's always been this media outpour of different things. And then I was speaking to my, and this is the total paradigm shift. I've got a friend who's, his daughter will likely be winning gold medal in skateboarding in 8 years. And I've got a few other friends who are Asian. They got all these people that train them and do these different things. And I was talking about Simone, and I thought, if you've got the twist like she had, the scariest thing is when you're taking from the village to the venue, because you're on your own.
Yeah.
Your family's not there. Your coach is not there.
Ooh. And these are COVID separation times as well. So, yeah.
And I used to always just put my, because I've been in those situations where you just put your face on the window and just get the cool feeling of the glass and just try and pretend that it's all going to be okay. And then you get there, then you open up in the stadium. And to have the wherewithal, and I was just saying to my friend actually today after the Simone Biles thing, you know, you can do all your work. What you have to do is be prepared that one day she'll get on a bus or a drone, whatever vehicle it is to get her from the camp to the venue, and know that if on that journey she thinks she won't be able to do it, she can get off and say, you know what? I'm not going in. Because the scariest thing when you're an athlete is you have to go into the arena. And you have to, even if you're scared, even if you know you're going to underperform. And that's, I guess, that's what the Olympics is quite lovely for that. But I would never wish that on any of my worst enemy is to be on that journey to the venue, to the stadium, and know you're not at your best, and then have the wherewithal to say, get off that bus and say, I can't do it today. Today I can't do it, because you spent decades, a decade of your life preparing for that moment. And so that's why I thought the Simone Biles thing was lovely, because I thought she was in it. She was in the heat of it. And she said, I can't do it today. And I spent 15 years doing this, but I can't do it today. And that's the biggest life lesson any of us can take, because sometimes you won't be able to do it. Yeah. And you're just going to have to get off the bus and say, guys, carry on. I'm not going to be there with you.
Yeah.
And it's such a kind of a lovely thing, but that's the romantic, tragic kind of side of me. But I think it's quite nice. I don't know what you think about that, Ned.
Well, I picked up on scraps of the story, I have to confess, but it's clearly resonated with, this is quite interesting. You're talking about kind of, younger generations being inspired by different kind of cycling, you know, and the kind of antics of the younger generation. Actually, the Biles story, as far as I understand it, has actually really resonated with younger people in my house who are staying here at the moment and who aren't necessarily interested in the sport whatsoever, but are very interested in what has happened at the Olympics and actually see that as a kind of a sign of progress, that these things are now acceptable in how we evaluate human performance, you know, and so, hats off. I think it's great. Listen, I haven't seen too much of the Olympics. I decided from a long way out I didn't care about these Olympics. I thought they were irresponsible, and I didn't think they should happen. And I actually think the Olympic games are dead on their ass. But once again, I've been kind of slightly suckered in by it. It is, you know, the magic, I was going to say every 4 years, but every 5 years in this case, does kind of weave its little spell around you, doesn't it? And so this morning I was fiddling around, sending some emails, doing some admin. And at the same time, I was listening to the BBC radio reporting on a British canoeist.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
I was totally invested in her. I'd never heard of her before.
It's the first time that we've had female single canoeist.
Did she win a silver medal in the end or something, or gold? I don't know.
Yeah,
because how much jeopardy is there? She touched the gate.
The Australian one.
Instantly, it's a 2 second time penalty, isn't it? Just touching a gate. Like, I think it's.
So just to affirm what you're just saying, is it means that. Because we treat sports in the domain we have, where we have TV, and even we kind of belittle ourselves because cycling is quite small.
Yeah.
Because we compare it to football and even in our country, cricket or rugby. But it's still a significant sport. Now, there are dozens and dozens of sports that don't get any TV coverage.
Yeah.
That people work their whole youth to be the best at. Olympics, canoeing. Mm. Olympics gives them the vehicle.
Not even Eurosport covers canoeing, does it? Maybe it does. I don't know.
It does actually. Because I kind of was watching Orla talk about it on Twitter. I wasn't actually watching Eurosport, but it's one of those weird things. And this is my dichotomy with the Olympics, is because with all my anti-doping stuff and all the work I've done, I was an Olympic event in Buenos Aires 4 years ago, and I got to actually confront Thomas Bach.
Yeah, he's the main man, isn't he?
Because they have no care for the athletes, zero care. It's all money. They have in their bank accounts at least £1 billion in cash, and yet they whinge about things. They make these demands. They don't really help people. Threw maybe €1 million. They would do something when Notre Dame burned down. They sent €1 million, you know, and it's like, oh, IOC sent €1 million.
Yeah.
They live in an ivory tower and they really don't care much about the athletes. And it really, but that's, I could go into that for hours and it can be found on record.
Because an athlete's career is transitory. You guys come and go. They can spit you out and chew you up and spit you out the other end. Yeah. And they are there to endure, and they've been there for 100 years, and they're getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, Tokyo has been pushed through against the will of an entire population, pretty much, as far as I can make out. And it is an act. So I go back to my original reservations. It's a desperately irresponsible environmental and health risk. You know, and Matt Rendell's right. The climate emergency is real right here. And I'm not sure we should be building huge concrete stadia that won't last the test of time and kind of flying people around the world.
This is a good anecdote, just so anyone who's doubting us. So when you had the London 2012 Olympics, the members of the IOC, the leadership team, they wanted to know how the royal family traveled around London.
Yeah.
And they made sure they traveled around the same way.
Huh.
That's an absolute fact that I know from London Transport.
Yeah.
That's how they treat themselves.
So they got those protected lanes, didn't they?
They got everything.
They literally did.
And so that's what they do. The IOC leadership team go to cities and find out how the president operates, how the royal family, whatever the leadership team of that country is, and expect to be served exactly like them.
Yeah.
So for an event that it has so much power and so much loveliness, the people that lead it are not, you wouldn't want to have dinner with them. I can first person tell you that.
Yeah. Hey, talking about getting round London, I've just been having dinner down on the riverfront in Greenwich with some friends and family, and in the distance we saw two Chinooks. If you live in Southeast London, it's actually quite a common sight because they land at the Woolwich Barracks. That's the first time. So if you know Greenwich, it's on the kind of epiglottis of, you know, the river bends right the way round. I showed you Greenwich, didn't I?
I loved
the
it.
The Isle
of
Dogs and all that sort of thing. And we saw them in the distance, and I said, watch this. These two Chinooks flying in formation, they'll follow the river all the way round in a big sweeping circle like that. And they sure enough did, and they came right over our heads, giving it the whole... and that's pretty cool. Don't know why I told you that, other than I thought you'd appreciate the kind of
I love it, because I love all military... I'm just trying to desperately look through Wikipedia why it's called Chinook. Because I think it's got something to do with a Native American name.
I would imagine it has. Sounds
But I can't
possibly...
remember why.
What's quite worrying is they were the kind of staple of the Vietnam War, weren't they, right? But Vietnam War...
No, you had... So the Vietnam War... There's a book you should read called Chicken Hawk.
Right.
By what's his name? I can't remember. It's an amazing book, and it's about where that was the first time they introduced airborne cavalry. So they were using a certain smaller type of helicopter,
okay,
and they would drop troops in,
yeah,
and then leave them out. And there's a book, Robert. I'll put it in the show notes.
But yeah.
Chicken Hawk is the most amazing book because it talks about helicopters and war.
Right.
And he was then out of...
Wasn't he Apache? No, it wasn't the Apache. That came later.
Yeah. It was the Huey.
Yeah.
But what he said was the reason that he wrote the book and did it, because he was then on the street for a decade afterwards, was that when he was flying the helicopters, he was trained to be a hawk. And yet when he was in the situations, he felt like a chicken because he was so scared.
Yeah.
And he'd be dropping in his helicopter into these crazy situations to pick people up, drop them off, come out. And he would always have the radio. He'd hear everything going on and he would be terrified. But his ability to go in and fix them made him a hawk. But he was terrified the whole time. Chicken Hawk.
Chicken Hawk. Okay.
Yeah. It's a beautiful book. Yeah.
Sounds cool. Hey, listen, just before I'm not in any sense wrapping you up here, but I know that I'll forget it unless I say it now, right? I want to say a happy birthday to my friend Jody in South Africa. Is that okay? Can I do that? It's my podcast, right? I can do that.
Yeah. You can do whatever you want.
Melinda Apples won't object, will they?
Well, what about Fuji?
Oh, we've got Fuji. Do you know the first job I ever had ever in Bedford was working for Fuji? That's interesting, isn't it?
That is interesting.
It was really funny, right? So I just left school. I was 17. I had a stringy mullet and I wore an army greatcoat. That's just for your visual reference point. And I went to a temping agency. These things don't really seem to exist to quite the extent that they used to, but every high street had a few temping agencies back in the day. And I said, give us a job. And they said, all right, you can start tomorrow morning at this industrial estate on the outskirts of Bedford. And the warehouse you have to report to is the Fuji warehouse. They used to make videotapes, didn't they? And video cassettes and, you know, all that sort of thing. And I went there, reported there first thing in the morning, and this site foreman led me and this middle-aged man called Andy out to a warehouse where we were shown boxes and boxes and boxes piled high on a pallet of Fuji videotapes, C-120s or VH-120s or whatever they were, all of which had been wrapped in cellophane with a promotional offer that had some incorrect information on it, right? And me and Andy's job was to take the cellophane wrappers off. On day one, we set about it because we didn't know each other. So silently, diligently, we set about it and did something like 10,000 on day one. Yeah?
Yeah.
At the end of the shift, on our way back to catch the same bus to go home, I said, if we carry on like that, Andy, we're going to be out of a job on Thursday. And so on day two, we did four. We literally hid from our bosses behind all these pallets and played cards. The great British workforce right there. It was like something out of I'm All Right, Jack. It was brilliant.
Oh,
that's amazing. There we go. So Never Strays Fuji. It's come full circle for me, David.
Never Strays Fuji.
I've moved on from Melinda Apples. I'm all about Fuji now. But I just want to say, so happy birthday to Jody, who's listening in Muizenberg in South Africa, where actually, she may not know this, but she's a very near neighbour of Nick Dlamini, who's moved to Muizenberg. So there we go. But also Jody and Scar, who are good friends of mine. And I just want to remember a couple of years ago, when last time I went out to South Africa to visit Jody and Scar. Scar, who is an ultra, and both of them are amazing boulderers, right? Rock climbing types.
Yeah, amazing.
But Scar is an extreme mountaineer as well, and has done all the big peaks of the Andes and everything with proper pickaxes and stupid altitude and all that kind of nonsense, and wants to, you know, really, really one of the, you know, and he's spent long periods of time in the Antarctic doing amazing stuff there and all that kind of thing. He's this wiry, extremely lovely, very fit South African guy. And he said to me, he's got a passing interest in cycling because he just loves everything that involves extreme fitness, right?
Yeah.
So cycling kind of falls in a bit like Nicole, a bit like your wife. So
yeah.
If it involves fitness and pain, I'm in. So on my way out to South Africa a few years ago, he said, Ned, why don't we, because they live in Muizenberg, which is on the Cape Peninsula. Why don't we, if I get a couple of bikes, why don't we ride the route of the Cape Argus? You know, that kind of big sportive race all the way around the Cape Peninsula, which is quite famously very windy, quite a lot of climbing, and it's quite long as well. And I went, yeah, that sounds painful, but all right, let's do it. But he knows, I know nothing about bikes, right? Scar knows absolutely nothing about bikes. And so we went there and he said, we'll do the ride. We'll set off super early tomorrow. I've got my neighbor. He's lent us a couple of mountain bikes.
Huh.
I'm like, what do you mean mountain bikes? He goes, yeah, mountain bikes. Cause we're going up mountains, aren't we? Yeah, but we're going up mountains on roads, Scar, on tarmac, like that. And he goes, yeah, well, that's all we've got. A couple of mountain bikes. And honestly, David, we set off and it was the longest. Well, we've suffered on bike rides together, haven't we?
We have.
This was
I was talking about it today.
It was 100 miles plus on a mountain bike riding the route of the Cape Argus, just me and him in this tremendously windy Cape Peninsula. It was honestly, for most of it, we were riding at something under walking pace.
Six
and that's my only other thing that I've got to say about mountain bikes. But tell me, how was your West Highland Way experience with Nicole and all that?
That was amazing. I mean, Nicole, there's a mountain biker, again, mountain biking, a Scottish guy called Rab Waddle, who's I've raced with at Commonwealth Games a decade ago, who then went off, so I became a coach, and then did what's called an FKT, fastest known time of the West Highland Way. And it starts in Morgai and finishes in Fort William. And it's 100 miles, it's 156 kilometers. And most people do it in 8 days, and it's a pilgrimage. And we could do a whole pod on this, Ned, which we will do, because I got stuff.
I got some audio content,
which we'll do in a future date.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was amazing watching my wife do it because she trained for it and prepared for it and did it really well.
Okay, let's just say she ran it.
She ran the thing. That's she ran it in 4 days.
You say that because that's yeah.
She ran it. She turned up and she ran it and she wake up. She was leaving wherever we were at 6 a.m. and just getting it done. So by 11 o'clock, it's like she'd run the marathon.
Wow.
Of the off-road trail, then we'd meet her for lunch, and then she was totally fine the rest of the day. I mean, what? That's Nicole. She's a machine. But we got to see Scotland that I'd never seen. We got to see things, and we had Mediterranean weather. My mum was there. And the reason we were doing it.
The best week ever, yeah, didn't you, for it? Amazing.
Ever. Yeah. And it was really good for me because I met my uncle that I'd never met before because my mum was adopted. And my wife was not just running it, but raising money while she was doing it and for a charity called Quarriers. And on the third evening, we met my uncle and he was adopted like my mum. So my mum was adopted, her brother was adopted, her other brother was adopted, all to different families. Mm. And they were looked after by the Quarriers, her brothers. Mm. And he's the chaplain. This is what's amazing as well. My uncle, my mum's brother, is the oldest serving chaplain in the whole of the British Army.
Amazing.
And he's a full blown chaplain theologist, and he's gone through it and done these different things, and an interesting man. Her other brother committed suicide because their mum committed suicide, and it's all quite darkness. But it was so nice to see the joy, kind of, and just the normality of just getting it done.
Yeah,
and yeah. So yeah, so that was it was good, and it's another one of those. I'm putting it, banking it in my head because I'd like to do something really lovely with that, Ned, and we can.
Well, let's do that.
We can talk about it because I've been thinking about that, and I think it's a good one for us to do. And I had one other one I wanted to just bring up, and I can't remember what it was.
What, another bit of any other business?
Yeah.
Do you have a dream or anything? Because I've had no dreams. I can't, you know, I was thinking I've today, no maybe dreams. I've got a dream I could tell you about. I'd stopped dreaming.
So this was it. It was, and this is properly never strays far. So, you know, like motor racing.
Like what racing?
Motor racing.
Oh, I know about motor. No, I don't know about it, but I know what it is.
So there's a guy called Matt Bishop, and he's called the Bish F1, and he's a gay correspondent. He's the chief comms for the Aston Martin F1 team, and he's an amazing... I've followed him for quite a long time, and every day he puts up an F1 story, a motor racing story.
Yeah.
And today's was about, in this day in 1973, Jackie Stewart won a race.
Okay, yeah.
But there was a 25-year-old called Roger Williamson that died. And he was his second ever F1 race. He'd won F3 championships. And his car flips a tire failure. And was the driver behind him called David Purley, stopped his car and got out of his car and went and spent 2 or 3 minutes trying to get him out. And couldn't get him out. And this is what changed everyone having fireproof suits from Marshalls and everything. And I made the foolish mistake of going on YouTube and watching it. And it's the most saddest thing you'll ever see, because you see David Purley trying to stop cars, trying to get the Marshalls to help him. You see him trying to try to flip the car over.
Mm.
You see him trying to do everything, and he can't do it. Mm. And he was given the George Medal, which is
the civilian military cross,
which is what Malta got, which is where I was born, and that's why I know about it. And it puts perspective to everything we do. And the closest we get in sport, we talk about these little things. But one of my loves of motor racing is, you're like, those guys, they were just idiots, spoiled idiots that ended up in those situations. And I recommend going and looking at that video, as macabre as it sounds, because you watch him not being able to help.
Hmm.
And he watched his friend just, he said, you could hear him scream, couldn't push the car over, nobody could help.
Oof.
And he suffocated, didn't burn to death. And then he's trying to wave down cars, but none of the other cars stopped because they saw his car parked.
Hmm.
And so they thought he was just trying to tell everyone to slow down.
Oh,
and he it was just...
Not waving, but drowning.
And you just see his body language. And I think it puts all of our dramas we have about sports and Olympics. Go and watch. And that's a slight glimpse of what people do every day of their life in different situations, and health workers and military. You were like, okay, we're just talking about, oh, I got bronze, not gold. Oh, I got off the bus. I didn't go to the venue. You imagine trying to push a car.
Yeah.
Try and lift a car over. It's when you're watching your friend burn to death. And that's what people do.
In summary, you know, we started off talking about the women's Olympic road race,
yeah.
David. Anna Kiesenhofer, who won it, was quoted as saying this after the race. Now I'm old, I'm 30, and I started to realize that all those people who say they know, they actually don't know. Many of them don't know, and especially those who say that they know, don't know, because those who do know say that they don't know. That's not bad as a post-race interview, is it?
That's existential.
We need to get Kiesenhofer.
Oh, we need to get Dara. We need to get Kiesenhofer on. We need to get Kiesenhofer on. We need to get Dara and Kiesenhofer on.
I'd love to speak to Anna Kiesenhofer on this pod, because I think she's amazing.
I think she'd be amazing.
She did something incredible.
And I think we need to get we might need to bring John Noonan back in.
Noonan's been quite quiet recently.
Let's bring Noonan back on. We need an astrophysicist.
Also, we need his take on Jeff Bezos.
Oh, yeah. Space.
Space final, in inverted commas, right?
The final frontier.
The final frontier, yeah. Like going to London involves going to the M25. Yeah. And just finally, David, so coming up rapidly, well, not that rapidly, but rapidly-ish, we might do a few. So I only just figured out, right, this year, we're not commentating on the Vuelta, which is annoying, because it's going to be an amazing Vuelta.
Yeah.
Right? I'm not going to be in Spain. You're going to be in Spain, but not in Spain. But maybe we need to do some Vuelta stuff, right?
I think we should do like a daily update.
Daily? That would involve...
Maybe bi-daily.
The Giro was amazing because I watched it every day because I was paid to watch it, right? I would have watched it every day.
Tri-daily?
So let's just say an occasional Vuelta-y thing, I think. Yeah, don't you think? And I think
unless we want to pay us for it.
Yeah, well, that's all in the court of the Apples people, isn't it? Or Fuji, if they want to chip in, given that they now know I was a former
Melinda
employee
of theirs.
So I haven't ruled out Fuji. This this podcast is brought to you by Fuji, manufacturers of videotapes back in the day in Bedford. But maybe we should think about doing an occasional Vuelta podcast called Never Strays Fandango. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Fandango is nice.
It wasn't me. Someone on Twitter suggested that. Never Strays Fandango. Quite like that. Yeah. But in the meantime, what we know we're going to do is a Tour of Britain one, a daily morning Tour of Britain.
Oh, yeah, because you're doing that.
And I'm doing that. And I will be doing, nice. We will do a morning show from the Tour of Britain, right? Which starts in Penzance and finishes in Aberdeen. So it's properly a Tour of Britain. And it goes to Wales as well before you start complaining about that. Obviously, it doesn't go to Yorkshire because they're...
I'm not going to complain about Wales.
No, not you. Just I'm talking about the listeners, you know.
Okay.
How can you call it Tour of Britain if it doesn't go to Wales? Well, it does, but it doesn't go to Yorkshire because it can't go to Yorkshire because Yorkshire, in cycling terms, is at war with Britain. Right, we know that. Or rather, Britain is at war with Yorkshire. I can't remember which way around it is. But we're still looking for a really... convincing title. I suggested Never Strays Farage. I think it's scared away some of our sponsors, the political association.
Fuji. Melinda.
Yeah. So I maybe we need to skirt Never Strays Farage. We had a couple of other good suggestions on Twitter. Someone said Never Strays Falala, like an English madrigal.
Never Strays Afar.
Never Strays Afar is quite good. Never Strays Afar. What, in a Shakespearean way?
It's like kind of a, like an Anglo-Saxon Arthur.
That's Afar. Quite. I quite like that. Never Strays Arthur.
Never Strays Arthur.
This is quite brainstorming.
It's like, a tribute to England, the Anglo-Saxon heritage.
I quite like
Never
that.
Never Strays Arthur.
Or the other one was Never Strays Near, which is also an option. It's an option. It's an option, right? So we've yet to settle on that.
Confines us.
But perhaps you could... Do you think you could get... I've forgotten the name of the guy who does the artwork. What's his name?
Vitor.
Vitor. Can you get him to knock up something? Never Strays Fandango? Fandango?
He'll be all over this. He loves this. He actually listens to this as well.
Oh, brilliant. Vitor, can you do something... Can you do something like Never Strays Fandango-ish? Yeah? And with a little bit of Spain chucked in there. And we'll do a bit of that because the Vuelta starts quite soon, David, right?
Yeah, and get on it, Vitor.
All right, okay. Get first the artwork, then the content. That's how we do things. Backload it. Nice to speak to you, David.
Nice to see you, Ned.
Who's editing this, you or me?
I can stick it together now.
Are you sure?
There won't be any music. There won't be any art.
No production values, mate. Just whack it out there. The punters will love it.
Good. Send it to me now.
I will do. All right. See ya. Bye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.